After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
I really think lineage is kind of key. I mean, it's key to Buddhism. It's how the Dharma exists, right? Mm-hmm. The Dharma doesn't exist out there in the ether. You know, in our world, the Dharma, it comes out of people's mouths. It's the people that carry on the teachings of the Buddha.
Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and today I'm speaking with scholar, researcher, and author Alexander Gardner. Alex is director and chief editor of The Treasury of Lives, a biographical encyclopedia of Tibet, Inner Asia, and the Himalaya. Alex completed his PhD in Buddhist Studies at the University of Michigan in 2007. His research focuses on the collaborative activities of three great 19th century Tibetan Buddhist masters. In 2019, he released the book, The Life of Jamgon Kongtrul the Great, from Shambhala. Alex now lives in the Upper Delaware River Valley of New York State with his husband, two kids, and their sheep and chickens. Welcome to the podcast. It's so wonderful to be speaking with you.
Yeah, same here. Thank you so much for inviting me on. This is a real treat.
Now, I'm curious about your children and the chicken and the sheep. Because I, you know, very famously grew up in New York City, and I thought,
right,
you know, steak was like from the supermarket. And so there's a different sense of interconnection, I imagine.
It's so wonderful to live with animals. I mean, every spring, you know, you see all the birds being hatched and you see, you know, the birds come back from the south and then just everything growing. And the seasons, you know, are so present. So it's wonderful. And I'm sort of giving my kids the childhood I wished that I had. I grew up in Vermont, nice. But not on a farm, right? But right. I always dreamed of living on a farm. So it's great.
So they think of the sheep and the chickens, not as dinner, I imagine?
As
friends?
Yeah. In fact, my son, I always tried to get my kids to be vegetarian and they resisted. But my son stopped eating chicken the moment he met our chickens. He just decided he couldn't do it anymore. So, yeah. You know, he knows what food is, and so it's a conscious choice now. When they do eat meat, they know what they're eating. So that's important.
Oh, yeah. So I'm so curious how you grew up in the States. You're born and raised in Vermont. How you became drawn to the historical figures from Eastern philosophy and Buddhist studies.
Right. Well, I always think back to my dad. My dad was sort of a seeker. He was a big fan of Ram Dass. You know, he had Ram Dass's books on his shelf when I was a kid, and he was always looking for the truth, you know, with the capital T. And so when I was 17, he took me and we did a course in transcendental meditation in Berlin.
Mm-hmm, nice.
And, you know, I mean, I don't do that anymore, but it really gave me a foundation of a daily practice, right? So that stuck with me. And, you know, I think at 17, I'm very impressionable, right? So I learned the value of that young. So I never had to be convinced of it. And then when I went to college, I fell in with this crowd of people who were Buddhists and had connections with IMS, actually. And so I learned Buddhist meditation. And And then we did that amazing retreat. After I graduated college, I was, you know, for 2 months, we sat in this Zen monastery in the Catskills, right, with these two amazing Tibetan teachers. And Surya
Das. Who would have guessed? It was extraordinary.
It was, for me, for a young person to sit beside you and Joseph and these other teachers, and Ram Das even came. Pleased to be able to tell my father that. And Surya Das would tell all of these stories, you know, of the great masters who transmitted the teachings. And they really resonated with me, their lives and their, you know, their activities. And I really felt devotion to them. They didn't, I don't know, I guess through those really charming stories, they didn't feel so far away, you know, and I just wanted to know more.
So great. I mean, it was such a magical time because looking back is like, how did we pull that off? That is unbelievable. On every level. I mean, Surya, of course, was the connection to Nyösha Kenra Rinpoche, who was a great, great, great teacher. And really like the teacher of my heart in so many ways. And figuring out how to get him for a while. And then Sokhen Rinpoche was his first trip to North America. He came from Argentina. And he's very fond of telling the story how, you know, in Argentina, they met him in the airport, looked like a band, you know, and like flowers and kissing him. And, you know, and then he got to America and it was like everyone was just sort of grim and quiet. And, and that we had him for 2 months, you know, it was like.
It's amazing.
It was amazing.
Yeah. I mean, and I was 21 years old. Yeah. I had no idea that this was, you know, I just thought, okay, this is the way retreats are. These incredible practitioners and teachers are all going to be surrounding me and I'm going to be able to, you know, absorb it all. It really felt like I connected with the most amazing Sangha that was possible.
No, I really treasure it, you know, because I was also, of course, very young. I was 18 when I started meditating in India. I was 21 when I began teaching. I was 23 when we began IMS and was way too young, really. But, you know, our time is different from that time. And that retreat we had was all the more exceptional because we live in a time where, not quite then, it was too long ago, but not too soon thereafter, not too, you know, long thereafter. It was all apps and, you know.
Right.
In the mindfulness industry. And,
right.
And the question of lineage was very, and not even secondary in people's minds often, you know, it's like unthought of.
Right.
So I'm curious about how you view the concept of lineage given all your experience and work in this field.
Well, I don't know. I really think lineage is kind of key. I mean, it's key to Buddhism. It's how the Dharma exists, right? Mm-hmm. The Dharma doesn't exist out there in the ether, you know. Mm-hmm. There's great stories and of the Pure Lands where the wind blows and then the leaves rustle and it's the sound of the Dharma teachings, right? But you know, in our world, the Dharma, it comes out of people's mouths, right? You need people, and so you know, it's the people that carry on the teachings of the Buddha. It's the people who receive it and then they practice it and then they pass it on forward. It's like a generational thing. And it's also a certificate of authenticity, right? I mean, you don't, being in a lineage doesn't make you a great teacher, but it's sort of like you could be a bad teacher, but it's needed, right? Because without that lineage, there's no connection to the Buddha. So, I think I don't know. I mean, it's the sort of the history and the sort of the lifeblood. And it's also at the same time, it doesn't discount innovation or change, you know, I mean, everything changes but you need the lineage. You need to know your lineage in order to know that your teacher, has that connection, has that authenticity, has that transmission.
I've often wondered, you know, because I not only started when I was so young, but I started in Bodh Gaya.
Wow.
Which is, you know, the first place I ever drew a mindful breath, as far as I recollect. And Bodh Gaya is the town that is grown up around the descendant of the tree. They say the Buddha was sitting under when he became the Buddha, when he became fully enlightened. And so it's a very, very holy place. It's a very it's a place that's seen apparently a great deal of growth and change lately. You know, I haven't been there in so many years, but you know, there's a beautiful, beautiful stupa, a temple behind the tree. And Joseph always said, I think quite aptly, he said, it's so beautiful, it's commensurate with what happened there. You know, which is saying a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my day, you know, when I was young, there was one Tibetan temple, there was one Chinese temple, there was the Burmese temple, which is where we all stayed down the road. There was one Thai temple, and there was a Gandhi ashram, and a couple of tailor shops, a few chai shops. That was it, you know. That was the town, and then the tree.
Right.
And so, you know, massive numbers of local pilgrims, you know, not international pilgrims at that time, but some Westerners. And I often wondered, you know, like, if that influenced me as well, that here I am in the place where the Buddha was when he became enlightened, and this is what he was looking at, you know, and this was his vista, and this is where he sat and ate some milk rice or kheer, anyone on their way to an Indian restaurant, you know, which is the last thing he ate before his enlightenment. You know, this is where he sat and ate that, and this is where he got up and did walking meditation after his enlightenment. And this is where he, you know, and it was like, he was like a friend, you know, who's there. He was so palpable in a way.
Yeah.
I've often wondered about that too, not to mention, you know, the incredible blessing of having really fine teachers.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think there's a palpable sense of his presence in Buddh Gaya. And that, I think, you know, we bring that. I mean, we bring that with our devotion. We bring that with our faith. And we say, this is where the Buddha, you know, like you were saying, this is where the Buddha sat. This is where the Buddha walked. This is where the Buddha awoke. You know, I think we're very physical beings, and we forget how important place is often. And Buddh Gaya is a really nice reminder of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love the way teachers, you know, from all over the world now, you know, go to Buddh Gaya, you know, give teachings or just sort of rejuvenate. And yeah, it's a magical place. But I like you, I haven't been there for probably 20 years.
It's going to be a while, I'm sure, if ever again. You know?
Right. You know, one more thing about lineage that I think is important that I think lineage, it sort of helps us remember that our teachers are a one link in a chain, you know, and in a way it sort of de-centers the teacher. I mean, the teacher obviously is vitally important. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that, but then, you know, the teacher is the transmitter of the Dharma.
Yeah.
The teacher's not the Buddha. Yeah. The teacher is the Buddha's representative in a way. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we venerate, you know, her as the representative, but as a human being, right? As a flawed human being,
it's
not perfect, and we can acknowledge that if we remember the lineage, remember our teacher was a student, our teacher, you know, had teachers herself, and our teacher, you know, I don't know, it sort of deflates the sort of excessive image of the teacher as everything, you know.
Yeah, which is vitally important.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, in Tibetan Buddhism especially, right? You venerate your teacher as the Buddha. That's an actual practice that you do. Yeah. That's very important. But you do that when you're in meditation. That, you know, you get off of your cushion and you have to remember your teacher is human.
Yeah. You know? Be careful.
Yeah.
Be very careful.
Yeah. You know, and it's not a new thing. You know, the text says, you know, they all say, you know, examine your teacher very well. Remember that your teacher is human. And then do this practice, but you're doing the practice. Your teacher is not doing the practice, you know?
Yeah.
So it's your devotion.
Yeah. Like when I wrote Faith, you know, which was some years ago, from the Theravadan point of view, you know, faith as a quality of the mind, is vitally important, but it's got phases and stages and aspects. And the first blossoming of faith for many people is what they call bright faith, which is like falling in love, you know. So beautiful. And it's like, the example that's usually used is like you're in a dark and closed room, the door shut, and then something happens so that the door swings open. And you don't know what's out there, but you know it's so much bigger than what's in there, you know? Like, the room is not the world, and there's a world out there, and so much could happen, and so much possibility, and so much, it could look so different than it looks in that sort of dim little corridor. And it's this amazing moment, and often essential, you know, and so beautiful, but so intoxicating at the same time. And also so, leaves you so vulnerable. First of all, you can be very fickle. It's like you can meet one, say it comes from meeting a teacher. It doesn't have to come from meeting a teacher, but let's say it does, you know. Meet one teacher one day and you think, that's it. I'm going to just follow that person. And you meet another teacher another day and you think, forget about that other one. You know, like, I'm following this one. And we get confused by charisma. We get confused by lots of other things. And then the biggest vulnerability is really that we become sometimes afraid to question and afraid to, you know, doubt, even though it's so vital to everything the Buddha himself talked about, you know, find out for yourself, put it into practice, check it out. And, you know, and then you get afraid of making waves and you don't want to bring up the things that are making you uneasy. And
you're afraid. You're afraid that your faith is weak or your devotion is flawed, right?
You know, and so kind of winding your way through all that and remembering that it's good to question, it's important to question, and that your faith will only be strengthened by doubt. It won't be weakened by doubt. It seems really it's a tricky path, but it's really important that we do that. Otherwise, we're staying stuck, you know, in some way.
Right. I think it's also important to remember, I can't imagine there's a bodhisattva out there who would be offended by being questioned, you know.
Right.
Like, let's remember who we're talking about. These are the representatives of the Buddha. They're not going to be angry if we question them.
Yeah.
That's their job, is to get us to think critically.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's true. I've often been in some situation where I'm in lots of different situations, but you know, either a situation where people seem to be saying that they're claiming the Dharma as their own. It's like they, almost they alone know what's true.
Right.
At one sort of bad moment, I said to somebody, if you've been teaching, and this was, the Western, and like, if you've been teaching all these years and you only, are you the only one who knows what's true? Like, what's happened to your students? You know, like, it's not very impressive, you know, like, really.
Right. Yeah. Again, that's why lineage is important, right? I mean, if any one teacher thinks that he or she is everything, then you know, they obviously don't know their place in the lineage. They don't have the humility of lineage.
We did an interesting thing when we began IMS too. I think it was very ahead of its time. It's not exactly the way it's run right now, but we decided on a separation of church and state so that the teachers would be really almost like a program committee of a board, you know, deciding who teaches here and what gets taught and things that they have spent years and years and years devoting themselves to trying to understand. But like all financial decisions and sort of, you'd say the real power, certainly the legal power of the organization is with the board of directors, and they were different. And we used to call it separation of church and state, which I like quite a lot.
That's smart.
And it became more unified body. Now it's shifting again because it's a lot of work being on a board of directors, you know. But I heard, especially, you know, in the course cultural world in which you and I have tended to grow up in, you know, in terms of Dharma, you know, the great veneration one might hold one Zen teacher, for example, when it has to do with working with a koan or working with your mind or working with your fear, would often translate into, what kind of truck should we buy, Roshi? You know? And the man knew nothing about trucks, but he'd seen a picture in a magazine or something like that.
Right.
So he'd say, oh, that one. You know,
right.
And like, so the whole organization was dependent on a field not really well studied. You know?
Right. Right.
It's very funny. So I'm really curious about Life of Jamgon Kongchul the Great, which tells the story of an influential Tibetan teacher from the 19th century What number of Kungcho was that? And which would have been the one that I met in
you would have met
him as a child?
Yeah, the third. You would have met the third.
Okay.
He was the one that passed away in the car crash, right?
Yeah,
when we were at that.
Yeah.
So this was the first Kungcho who really, he was said to be a reincarnation of somebody, but it was really, he was a sort of a self-made individual in that sense. So I remember hearing stories again, you know, Surya Das told us stories, at the retreat. And then I traveled in Asia after that retreat and I finished college, I traveled a lot in Asia. And then I when I got to grad school, I did language study in Sichuan province in China, where Dengue and a lot of Calm is nowadays. Mm-hmm. And you can't go 10 miles in that region without coming across the impact of Kungcho and his two colleagues, Jamyang Khinse Wangpo and Chögyal mm-hmm. Lingpa. I mean, they just mm-hmm. went everywhere. They sanctified the whole landscape with caves and monasteries and stupas and mountains, and they just mm-hmm. they connected everything with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It was it's just really astonishing amount of work. And so, you know, me who grew up in Vermont, I loved the forest and I loved the hills and I loved the landscape in Calm is so beautiful. And I thought if these people were out there, you know, and these people really cared about these mountains and they knew these mountains, you know, they told their stories and I just really, that really resonated with me. So, and then Kungcho, I mean, it's just, the more I studied and the more I practiced, the more I realized that, almost any, in Tibetan Buddhism, almost any Nyingma or Kagyu or even so much Sakya sort of teachings flowed through Kungcho. He was just instrumental in gathering up all available teachings, sort of organizing them and then transmitting them. And he did the one vital thing that he did was he published. Mm-hmm. He gathered up all these revelations that had been floating around in Tibet, all these incredibly beautiful teachings that just existed in one manuscript. And he published, he made these huge collections of teachings. Mm-hmm. So that we have them, and that was very it's a vital thing he did. And then again, I could talk about Kungcho all day, but another thing that mm-hmm. that I love Kungcho, he's sort of the paragon of Tibetan ecumenicalism, right? He's mm-hmm. He just loved everything. He had this insatiable curiosity for the teaching, this great love and appreciation for all the different teachings that Tibet had created by that point. And so he just went around and he gathered them. He received them and he practiced them. And he did it in this really beautiful way where he respected the integrity of each teaching, right? He didn't sort of like take the stuff that he liked and merge it all together and make a new thing. He mm-hmm. didn't. He was very, very careful about keeping each teaching intact. So we would come up with these massive compendiums of teachings, and they would mm-hmm. all be the right sections. This is the Nyingma section. This is the Northern Treasure section of the Nyingma. You know, everything was in its place, and so someone could go to it and practice that. You know, because each teaching was a whole unto itself, right? It was a complete path, and so he wanted to make sure that those paths stayed distinct, and he loved them all equally. And I think that's just a very beautiful way of mm-hmm. seeing the world, right? I mean, we're so parochial these days. We're so wrapped up in what we have. You know, Kungcho, it's not that he didn't have his own tradition. I mean, he had his own monasteries, he had his own institution, he had his own practices, but he didn't say those were better. Mm-hmm. He said, this is what I do. I mean, this is where mm-hmm. I'm standing, and I'm going to stand here and I'm going to look out at the world and appreciate it. And you stand where you're going to stand, and appreciate it. And we're going to get along because we're both doing something that's worthwhile. And we can learn from each other and we mm-hmm. can share ideas. And that's just, what a model of for the world.
You would have been a young teenager too, maybe like 12 when I met him or something.
Oh, the third.
A teenager, yeah. It was a long time ago. And he was impressive even then, in the midst of outstanding other young teachers, you know?
Right. Yeah, I never met him. I wish I had.
Yeah. He was very beautiful. Yeah. Is there a rebirth? Is there a fourth?
He must be in his 20s or 30s. I haven't met him, though.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. No, the Tibetans are very good at finding the reincarnations of their teachers.
They are. They're very good at that.
It doesn't always work, but it's definitely produced some remarkable teachers. Yeah.
Is there anything you found out in your research about Jamgon Kongtrul Rinpoche that surprised you? That was...
Well, there's definitely like his rime, you know, his non-sectarianism
mm-hmm.
is definitely well known, and people talk about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's great. But I think the more I sort of learned about him and sort of got into his head, so to speak, to the degree that, you know, someone like me could mm-hmm. ever do that. It was more than that. It was, I think of his non-sectarianism as a form of pure vision. You know, mm-hmm. it wasn't just that, you know, the Kagyu and the Nyingma are okay, but it's really almost breaking down the us and them and the, you know, mm-hmm. the duality of all things.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of, that unity of two truths. I mean, Kongtrul, there he was in the world, very much involved in institution building, and yet mm-hmm. approaching everything with this pure vision in which this is all made up, this is all impermanent, this is mm-hmm. all, you know, a construct of our mind and of our activity, and mm-hmm. really, it's all empty. And so, you know, I think ultimately what his rime, what his non-sectarianism means is really, it's just that, it's non-duality, it's a...
Mm-hmm.
It's an awareness and a of emptiness and an engagement with the world, with the view of emptiness. And I think, you know, I started thinking of Kongtrul. In a way, I kind of started the book as a response to a lot of depictions of him as this sort of like, I don't know, kind of like airy fairy floating on cloud, you know, perfect from birth, you know, great, you know, celestial being.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, the way that, you know, the great masters tend to get depicted sometimes, you know, it's just like aloof and I thought, no, Kongtrul was really here. He was on the ground. He was walking, you know,
mm-hmm.
he was getting his hands dirty, you know, and I think that's what's most exciting about him, is he was there in the world getting his hands dirty with this attitude of non-duality,
awareness,
you know. So in a way, I wanted to write this biography of him, you know, Kongtrul the person, but by the end of the book, I really said, this is a Buddha, my goodness.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, a Buddha is a person, and that's, I think we have to remember that.
Yeah, like I was on a panel with Jamgon Kongtrul Rinpoche once, which is, these things are so mortifying to remember, you know, like, why did they put me on a panel with him?
Wow.
But there was an early, early psychotherapy and Buddhism conference. And I was on this panel with him and Jack Engler, who's a friend, who's a clinical psychologist. And something came up in the course of the panel with one of the questions where I just said, you know, like, you have to understand the context in which at least some of the people on this panel are holding, you know, this teaching. I said, they have lost everything material. Their families, in some cases, have been killed. You know, their stature, their sense of security is gone, you know, like, and there's one story, I don't know if you remember, that Nyerso Ken told in that month that he was with us, where he talked about, at some point, he too was not born of great lineage and, you know, had a very humble background. His father was a bandit, you know, which he would tell us these stories about. And whatever renown he attained was because of his scholarship and his dedication to his own being, you know. And so then he was kind of the toast of the town, for whatever little remote town in Tibet somewhere. And then the Chinese invasion came and he had to leave. And so, you know, the last iteration of his life in Tibet was sitting on high thrones and
right.
being venerated and being respected. And then he said, and then I ended up a beggar on the streets of Calcutta.
Right.
And you know, so my heart was like broken and I was full of sorrow and I was all upset. And then he said, and I was very happy. And I thought, what? You know, like, what? That didn't compute. And you know, he said, go out and beg for enough pennies to get some chai and whatever. I had enough, you know, like.
Yeah, he wandered all over India.
He wandered all over India. Yeah. With the sadhus.
Yeah, and people didn't realize. I think it took time for even the Tibetans to realize that, oh my goodness, this is a great practitioner and a very skilled teacher.
You know, so they're sitting on this panel with Jumgun Kongcho in some hotel ballroom, you know, and everyone is talking about the fine points of this and that, but you realize there is a context also to the historical reality of preservation and what that means and what it means when everything's in danger and texts are destroyed and teachers are imprisoned. And it came bursting out of me, you know, in that moment.
Yeah. And if the first Kongcho hadn't, you know, published these books, hadn't gathered these teachings, they would certainly have been lost 100 years later. Yeah.
And it's that much harder to start all over again, you know, you think, well.
Yeah.
And that brings us to Treasury of Lives. How did that happen? How did that come about?
So I finished grad school in Michigan, and I went to work for Gene Smith, who started the Tibetan Buddhist Resource Center, now the Buddhist Digital Resource Center. And he was being sponsored by the Rubin family in New York. And so from working for Gene, I went to work for Don and Shelley, so who you know, and started the amazing Rubin Museum of Art in New York. And, you know, they had this amazing collection of Himalayan art and all these portraits of lamas. Don would always ask visiting monks, you know, who is that guy? Who is this picture? And, you know, they wouldn't always know. And he just became convinced that the world needed a website that explained all of these things. Mm-hmm. Good. So he got Matthew Ricard and Vivian Kurds and Mok Mokotov to start sort of they did a prototype of sort of like a what's what and who's who of Tibetan Buddhism. So they completed that. And then I came on to take it over. And I decided that we would just sort of pare it down just to biographies. So that's, you know, when we called it the Treasury of Lives, because we're, you know, that's, it sounds Tibetan, and it also, you know, it's all about the lives that these people lived. And, you know, and I was fortunate, you know, again, to work with Gene on starting it, and Jeff Watt, who runs the Himalayan Art Resources, and all the great folks at the Rubin Museum. So it's been, I think we're like 17 years old.
Wow, yeah.
Run for a while. Yeah. And the tech, you know, I mean, like, I'm a total technophobe. So I'm running an online, you know, encyclopedia. I'm very, very lucky, I have to say, to my colleague at the Treasury, Katie Tsuji. She's very, very adept at tech and is also a Mongolian scholar. So she adds that dimension. Yeah, we've had a great team.
That's great. Because, you know, you just get the sense there's so much knowledge. And it is a body of knowledge. And you don't want any of them, even if it's something you're not personally going to undertake or you feel is best tucked away somewhere, you know, is not something you want destroyed.
Right. Yeah. And I love the stories of people, you know, I mean, from my very young age, I've always been fascinated by biographies. You know, it's like, and in Buddhism and traditionally biographies are very, very important because they're both the map and the inspiration, right? I mean, these are the people who did it, right? These are the lives of this is how they did it. They went from, you know, from nothing or, you know, they went from a normal person like you and me, you know, always starts like you and me. And then they listen to the teachings and they practice the teachings and they master the teachings. And that's, you know, it's always, and you can too, you know, this is something that everybody can do. This is a mm-hmm. teaching that's available. You know? And I think that's very inspiring.
So was that like a leap into technology, or it was just, you had to do it?
I just had to do it. I mean, we were lucky. I mean, Don was very generous that we were able to hire people to mm-hmm. do it. You know, and I think, like, I've had offers to, like, publishers would like to come out with, you know, printed versions of the Treasury, you know, and that's mm-hmm. a nice idea, but I think you'd lose so much, right? I mean, one of the great things about the internet is the connectivity, right? The mm-hmm. links. So, you know, we can show how in any biography, how this person studied with all of these different people. And then you can click through to their biography, and you can, mm-hmm. you can show how place was so important, how this monastery or that cave was so important. You can click through to that place and get a description, and then find out who else studied there or practiced there. Mm-hmm. You know, you can really go back and forth and just go onwards and see all of these connections. I think it's, you know, that's the glory of the internet. So.
That's really interesting, because I wonder if the sense of agency, like you get to choose what you're going to click through to, makes some difference. Because I'm more recently, in a very amused way, you know, was confronting guiding meditations on some electronic means, like an app, you know, or a website or something like that, and not thinking to explicitly explain that when I become silent, I'm giving meditation instruction and I'm meditating myself. And then when I become silent, I'm meditating myself. And that's the cue for you to keep going, you know, right. Rather than, like, people started telling me, like, you don't understand. Like, people start writing in saying, my app is broken. It was just silence. And then they beam me in. This is pre-COVID. They beam me into some business conference somewhere. I forget why I was even there, but there was some reason I was there. And I said yes, and I saw people were writing in the chat, the live stream is broken. She's just wow. silent, you know.
Wow. And I thought,
oh my God, it's true, you know. Like, and it just never occurred to me to say, this is what silence is for.
Right, right.
It's yeah. for you to put it into practice.
Yeah, silence on the web means something's broken. Right.
Yeah, that's right. It's so funny.
So how do you deal with that on an app? I mean, I've never actually used a meditation app. I mean, like you don't want the person talking the whole way through.
No, no. What I do is I try to remember to say it somewhere in the, this is a whole big introduction, you know, sit comfortably, you can have your eyes open or closed, whatever. I try to say somewhere in there, when I become silent, that's the signal for you.
Right. Right.
To put into practice what I've just suggested.
Right. Right.
You know, so that maybe even if they largely forget, they'll kind of remember, oh, you're right, I'm supposed to do something there.
Wow. Yeah, technology is, it's a, you know, it's a blessing and a curse. There's so much opportunity. And yet, mm-hmm. you know, when it becomes a replacement, you know, the teachings are so valuable when you're sitting with other people. It's so key.
Yeah. Yeah.
But COVID has made that so hard, you know. I mean, of course we have to rely on technology now.
So. Yeah, I mean, I have not, as of yet, in the time we're recording this, you know, really taught in person, you know, so that's interesting.
Wow.
And related to that, in a way, is another question I wanted to ask you, because I had a book, Real Change, that came out in 2020. It came out in... I think it was September 2020, and it was due. It was supposed to come out in June. So it was delayed a few months because of the pandemic, and which gave me the opportunity, as many people listening to this blog know, it gave me the opportunity to go back to the publisher and ask if I might write a new preface to the book, because the very few people who were already reading the book were reading it, like to excerpt it and something like that. And this friend said to me, I really liked what you're writing, but those examples are driving me crazy. And I keep thinking, that's what made you anxious? Well, you see what's coming. You know, like, and so I went to the publisher quickly and I said, would it be all right with you if I wrote a new intro? Because I just feel the need to put some context around what we're going through. And they said yes. And so the overriding question for me in order to prepare that intro was, what's still true? Mm. Well, your plans are gone. You know, I thought it was going to be in New York. It was gone. There was so much that was uncertain or unknown or just falling apart.
Yeah.
And so that became the most profound element, actually, I think, of that exercise, is just asking myself, like, what's still true? And that reminds me of the word Dharma and its meaning of that which we rely on.
Right.
And that which we can count on. And so your book was not that long before then, you know, July 2019.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you went through a process and if you were asking yourself something like, what's still true?
I mean, certainly not for the book, because the book, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, maybe I could say that. I mean, I think about COVID and I try to think like, what are we better off for? Like, what did we learn? Mm-hmm. What are we coming out for? Where's the silver lining? And I'm still stuck in, oh my goodness, we're all still suffering, right? And not only that, but things got so bad for so many people that just the amount of suffering in the world was the existing suffering, the inequalities, the injustices, you know, the racial injustice and the economic inequality. I mean, it just laid bare, but even got worse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then I think, well, but we know that now in a way that we didn't before, right? The Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, it just made us confront the COVID made us confront the realities of our healthcare system and of the income inequality. So maybe, like, I don't know, like I feel like the world is burning, right? And I think of like Greta Thunberg, her amazing statement. You know, we need to act like the world is burning because it is. You know, our house is burning because it is. You know, it makes me think of the Buddha's parable in the Lotus Sutra. You know, where he tells of a father whose children are inside of a burning house and they won't come out because he just can't get them to believe that the flames are there. They just are ignorant of it. So he makes up a story of this marvelous chariot that's outside that will excite them and then get them running outside to see the chariot. And there's no chariot. He made that up, but he got them out of the burning house. And I feel like that's where we are. We're in this burning house. We need those teachings. You know, we need the Buddhist teachings to be aware of it, to help us know that it's there, but not just to know it, but be able to manage that knowledge with compassion, right? And with mindfulness and be able to breathe through it because it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And that's, for me, that's still true. The Buddhist teachings are all the more needed because the Buddhists taught us how to face suffering, how to face crisis, and how to do it with compassion, you know, for ourselves and for the people who are suffering with us, and even for the people who, you know, we might otherwise, you know, hate because of it, you know, the anger that swells up in us, you know, in the face of all these injustices, you know. So I would say the Dharma is still true for that, you know, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm, really? And I'm wondering also about these beings that you've studied, you know, if there's something that you would draw from that body of knowledge, that expertise. Is Dharma in general, or did somebody have some, like, I often talk about, you know, when I talk about my own teachers, like, some of my teachers were very kind of witty, you know, and they could say things in one sentence that would just, like, change your whole perspective.
Right.
And another teacher, like this woman, Deepa Ma, who's actually the person who told me to teach. I don't know if I can remember a single thing she ever said to me. Honestly, you know, it was all her being.
Oh, right.
And how tremendously loving she was. I mean, I do remember some things like, you should teach. That was important, you know, but, or you can do anything you want to do. It's your thinking. You can't do it. It's going to stop you. That was helpful too.
Right.
But for the most part, you know, day to day in terms of instruction or
right.
perspective on life, it was her incredible, loving, compassionate presence that was more important than anything. So they're all kind of different too.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, we've, we have this this three-year grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Mm-hmm. That it's just been a godsend. I mean, we're a tiny little project, right? And so it's, and the work that we're doing for that is biographies of 20th century people. Mm-hmm. So we're putting up all these biographies of people who, you know, were born, raised in Tibet and then went into exile, or mm-hmm. or who spent 20 years in Chinese prison, or, you know, people who faced a crisis, like you were saying, like the real, like the collapse and the destruction mm-hmm. that Tibet experienced in the 20th century is you know, one of the great tragedies of human civilization, if you ask me. And they persevered. You know, these individuals, they, you know, maybe they were in Chinese prison for 20 years and they survived, and maybe they didn't. Maybe they died in the end. But, mm-hmm. but we have stories of them being kind in prison, mm-hmm. stories of them meditating and even teaching mm-hmm. in prison. And you know, not everybody can do that. Not everybody has the capacity to do that. That's what makes these, you know, great teachers. Certainly in the face of crisis, everybody responds differently, but there's an inspiration there, I think, that sort of persevering in the face of crisis. Mm-hmm. And again, by relying on really simple truths of kindness and compassion and sort of managing one's anger and channeling mm-hmm. one's anger at injustice, you know, so that it doesn't burn you out, but it burns, mm-hmm. burns mm-hmm. you into doing, you know, a good deed or mm-hmm. so. Yeah, we have stories like that I think are timely for sure.
Yeah. It actually would be, you know, probably a very big help to people right now. Just sort of those examples of endurance, of hanging in there, of finding, not exactly finding the good in the sense of enjoying, you know, terrible circumstance, but being able to not only live day to day in a better way, but engage in seeking change in a better way.
Right, right. That resilience is really key.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very interesting because it's also now, if you're talking about Tibet, we're talking about trauma and it's, you know, most fundamental form, although I'm not sure they recognize that or believe it, you know, that, that it's part of their worldview, which itself is interesting.
Right.
And you've written recently some pieces for Tricycle Magazine, Mother of Tulkus.
Oh, yeah.
And another entitled Sex and Gender Fluidity in Tibetan Buddhism.
Right. Right.
These both sounds like you're asking some very interesting questions about Buddhism.
Yeah, the fun stuff, right? I mean,
really.
We're doing this series for Tricycle Magazine with BDRC and 84,000 on the sources of Buddhism. So BDRC talks about books and libraries, and 84,000 talks about scriptures and the Dharma, and we talk about people and the lives that they lived. So I wrote about this amazing woman, Tuku Urgyen, who is a great teacher in Nepal, his grandmother, who stood up to bullying monks. And I told the story about from Jamgon Kongtrul of a dream that he had in which he made love to his friend Kensei Wangpo, both of them in different bodies in previous lives. So the first one, I was making the point about how strong women exist in Tibet and in Buddhism. Mm-hmm. which, you know, you'd think you wouldn't have to make that point now, but you still do. Mm-hmm. So I've been actually going around lately saying publicly as often as I can that, so on the Treasure of Lives, we have 1,311 biographies, and only 49 of those are of women, which is a terrible, 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 you know, shameful thing. That's 3.7%, and it's mm-hmm. ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tibetan Buddhism is... You know, it's definitely male dominated. It has been, you know, monasteries were run by men for men, and most of the lineage holders are men, but not all of them. There's always been amazing female practice centers and amazing women teachers. So they've just been ignored. Mm-hmm. And historians have been ignoring them. They'll like sort of mention their names, you know, oh, so and so's wife was an amazing practitioner, and then go on to something else. You know, like, well, tell me about her, right? I mean, And Western scholars, we have our own patriarchy, and so we also ignored those references. But that's been changing. There's some really amazing scholars now who are paying attention, both Tibetan scholars and Western scholars who are starting to really pay attention to these women. So I wanted to tell the story of a great woman who stood up to the bullying of monks. And and then the other one I wanted to talk about gender. It's so present right now, like this talk of gender fluidity, right? And so these two scholars that I love, Janet Giazzo and Jose Cabazon, who you both know, and they've been doing really terrific scholarship on gender and sex in Buddhist literature. Mm-hmm. And then the scriptures are full of it. I mean, there's so much anxiety about what is a man, because it's a man. In order to ordain, you have to be a man. You can't be a woman. Well, what's the difference between a man and a woman? Their categories were never firm. There was always a sort of a third. There was always a sort of excluded middle, sort of both or neither man or woman. And they were so nervous about it because they were so nervous that, a non-man would present as a man and ordain. Mm-hmm. You're sort of hard pressed in Buddhist literature to find a positive example of this sort of this fluidity. But when I was researching Kwong Tril's life, he tells this dream in which he's really distressed because his mother had just died, and he's really sad. And he has this dream in which it's all these details. I won't tell the whole story, but there's this point in which Kensei Wangpo sort of comes to him. And they spend the night making love, and they do it by they sort of shifting identities and shifting genders within the dream. Sometimes he's Kwong Tril, sometimes he's not, sometimes he's Kensei, and that sort of that fluidity as an expression of love was really appealing to me. Right? It's okay. Right? It was an actual beautiful. Opposed to the condemnations and the fear and the anxiety of this gender fluidity, here's an example of gender fluidity in the service of love. And I just love that. As a gay person, I want more, I want more awareness and more sort of visibility for sort of the non-heterosexual, in the world, And I do think that teachers... There's this great interview with Allen Ginsberg. I think he did it in like 1973. He was a student of Trungpa Rinpoche and other lamas. But he asked Rinpoche, is there any issue with being gay? And Rinpoche said, why? Why would there be? He said, there's no issue. I don't care. It's nothing. And I think it's so important that we hear from lamas that sexuality is okay.
Which is different.
Yeah, because you get the texts are full of, all these very monastic presentations of sexuality in which you can't do this and you can't do that. And, they're so heteronormative. Mm-hmm. And so you look at the texts, it's a real bummer. But, the living teachers who are teaching to human beings, they're they're much more responsive to the needs of people, and they mm-hmm. recognize the humanity, right? The texts don't always recognize humanity, but a good teacher will.
Something that happened during that long retreat was that a friend of mine, one of the very first friends or acquaintances or anybody I knew that had AIDS, died. And I got facts about it. That's how long ago it was. And somewhere in the facts, it said, this person died and that, he chose the time of his passing or something like that. So it was pretty clear, that he'd somehow taken pills. He'd gotten enough pills that he could decide to die. And so I went off with Surya to see Nyasha Kenrinpoche and ask for some prayers for him. And said just a little bit. And Kenpo said, of course I will pray. And then Surya went into greater detail about the circumstances of his death. And asked Kenpo what he thought about that. And Nyasha Kenrinpoche, in a completely typical move for him, you know, but very, very unusual response I've ever heard with that kind of question. Said, as a Buddhist, how could I ever say it's right to take your own life? And as a Buddhist, how could I ever say it's right to suffer endlessly?
Right.
You know, and I thought, whoa, look at that.
Right.
Which is, yeah. I think, very much what you're saying. You know, there's a human being there.
Right. Right. And it's complicated. And and the great masters are comfortable with that. With the sort of multiple truths at any one moment.
Which is, I think, something we all have to, looking back at lineage and looking ahead toward the future, and even looking at now is a living expression for any one of us of the teachings, is something we have to remember.
Yeah. 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 People are complicated.
Yeah.
We're deeply flawed and we're all doing our best.
Yeah. It's very, very true. Is there anything further you want to say about technology, by the way, since you're right in the midst of it?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's one of those things, right? I wish we didn't have it, and thank goodness we do.
Mm-hmm.
I love unplugging, and yet, you know, here we are doing this conversation. I'm so grateful to be talking with you.
Yeah.
You're over in Massachusetts. I'm in upstate New York, you know, with Lily helping us. I don't even know where I'm sitting. And, you know, thank goodness that... You know, we can do this, and then this is going to go out into the world, you know, virtually, and that's such a great gift, you know. But thank goodness I can, you know, I can turn off all my devices and go sit with my sheep.
Right. That's so funny.
I need that.
Yes, Lily's in Berkeley.
All right.
Okay, so I'm going to thank you so sincerely for coming to speak with us. You know, my life in New York was a lot of fun when I ran into people like you, and we could have tea at the River Museum or something like that.
Sure, and I had to tell the story of how I ran into you at a lunch once.
That was very funny.
Garrison Institute, I think it was.
Yeah, it was.
Garrison. And I sat down and said, oh, sure, and how, and you looked at me and said, oh, and then you leaned over and you opened this big, huge bag, this like carpet bag, and you were rummaging through and you pulled out a clown nose and you said, this is for your daughter. I don't know what it was that someone had given you a clown nose, but you saw me and immediately thought of a daughter. And I love that because it, you know, it shows how, I don't know, how kind you are and how aware you are of everyone around you. I don't know.
Thank you. Yes, it's my Mary Poppins bag. It's like the bane of my existence. It's like, no wonder I can't stand straight anymore. You know? But it's a different time. It's so odd, you know, like our isolation and our minds, you know, but here we are. How lucky to have one another. It's true.
Right, right. Thank you so much for having me on. That was just a real joy.
Oh, it's great delight. And thank you all for joining us and to learn more about Alex's work. Though not his sheep, you can visit treasuryoflives.org or find his book, The Life of Jamgon Kongchul the Great, available in hardcover and ebook formats. Thank you for everyone for listening. This has been the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at sharonsalzberg.com.